When I think of growing up, I think of bedtime stories and my dad telling me about his early years on a family farm in Depression-era Missouri. His stories were populated by hard people leading hard lives, a world away from my suburban childhood. I'm the youngest of four boys, born 11 years after my youngest brother. So depending on who you talk to, I'm an afterthought, an accident, or a miracle. So my dad was old. Older than all my friends' dads. What little hair he had left was a black stripe slicked to his head. He used to tuck me in, sit on the edge of my bed, rub his calloused hands together, and tell me those old stories over and over again. Stories about my dad, my uncles, and my grandparents sharing a three-room house on the prairie of western Missouri.
Jerry had the footballs. Well, he'd run on up the hill and took the sled and going to show us guys up, you know. And he got up there and they cleared the top of that hill and come down, and he was really a sailor. And he got down there about half. They come to that fence and started to turn, and the runners wouldn't cut in, and he couldn't turn it at all. Just head on into that fence. And just wiped out the whole front of his face, you know, and broke his nose and cut his chin. And he was the sorriest looking beat up mess I ever saw in my life, I think, you know. So they took him to the doctor and got him stitched up. Monday we went to school, and of course he was all taped up and everything and scarred up, looked pretty bad. Well, I taped up my hands and told him that we told the kids at school that we got in a fight. And that's about the size of that story.
And I never got tired of it. I asked to hear them time and again until I got too old for that stuff. When I was in sixth grade or so, I used to say, "Dad, tell me a story." And Dad would say, "Oh, I don't know any more stories." Some of the best stories came from a later period, after Dad's family moved to Oregon. In 1952, at the age of 20, Dad moved away from home for the first time. He and a friend decided to move up into the Oregon Cascades to a tiny logging town named Valsetts.
So let's river run through it, and they dammed up the river to make a mill pond. And they had a big sawmill there, and a planer mill, and a drying shed for kill drying. And then they had a little cafe there that, you know, you could go in and buy a hamburger or meal, whatever you wanted. And then they had bunkhouses that we all stayed in, and there was like four guys stay in one bunkhouse. It was just a kind of a rectangular shed type building. It was all built up on stilts about 3 feet high, I guess, and it rained an awful lot there. They were all that high to keep them out of the water, and the company owned all the land there. You couldn't own property there.
I was 24 years old when I finished college. I moved home for a week while I was looking for an apartment, and I wanted to get Dad's memories of Valsetts down on tape. So I borrowed a tape recorder and a microphone and asked my dad to tell me about Valsetts. We set up some chairs in my parents' walk-in closet, the most soundproof room I could think of, and sat down to talk. Dad spent 6 months working the mill's green chain, a 16-foot-wide conveyor belt that carried freshly cut boards away from the saws.
2x12s come off, you'd have a pile of 2x12s. You'd put the 2x12s on that one pile, and the 2x4s, you'd have a pile of 2x4s, and a pile of 2x6s, and 1x10s, or, you know, 1-inch lumber. And then when you got a pile, probably, oh, 4 foot, 4 or 5 foot high, they had a jitney, which was a tractor that was high up in the air, and it had feet on the side of it that went spread out, and they go into that pile and drive right over it, and some blocks they put underneath it to was off the ground so you could get under the jitney and keep your pile level and everything. They just squeeze their jaws tight on that and pick up the box and haul it off and put it wherever they was going to store it, take it over to the planer or whatever, you know. And then you'd set some more blocks and start a new pile.
Soon after moving to Valsetts, Dad began to get sick. He didn't know what was wrong.
I weighed about 180 pounds, and within about 3 or 4 months, I was down to 148. And I was real nervous, and I started drinking 3 or 4 gallons of water a day. And I had a real hard job working out on the green chain, pulling, stacking lumber. And I would just stack all my share. I'd come along and reach over and help the guys on each side of me that were stacking lumber on both sides and do maybe half of theirs. I mean, I'd eat a lot, and it just didn't do any good, you know, losing it all in sugar. And so they finally went to the doctor several times, and finally he came up with the conclusion that I had diabetes. They put me on insulin, and they put me on 3 shots a day, which did the job pretty well, but it, you know, it'd make me have reactions really bad. And it was very tough for me socially, because I was drinking a little beer and stuff, and I had to stop that. And you can know, people go out and get a sandwich, and you couldn't eat that. You couldn't, just a lot of things you couldn't do. I worked hard, but it was tough. You know, getting low blood sugars and stuff. A lot of times would wake up in the morning with somebody and pouring juice down me because I was unconscious. That's the only way they could get me to come around. And had a few times when I was really, really out of it bad. I'd be choking, and every muscle in my body was pulled tight. A lot of people live for 20 years with it, and a few live to be 30 years, and there had been a few cases that lived to be at least as much as 40 years with it. And I never really expected to get as old as I am.
Living with diabetes in Valsetts was hard on Dad, especially in a place that was hard enough on its own.
And there was a lot of accidents happening up there. Like, they cut slabs off of logs on a big head rig, and then they would run it on some conveyors over to a edger and run it through there and cut the barks off the edges and, like, have about 4 or 5 saws that spread different distances apart, depending on what size lumber you're going to make. This guy walked behind this edger one time when a slab was going through it, and it jammed up and threw a stick back, hit him in the edge of his nose. It just went in like a rifle bullet, went in the side of his nose and out through his eye and out through the other side of his head over on the temple. They took him into the hospital, and they said, well, he had 2 to 3 hours to live, and I saw him about six months later at a ball game, and he was blind. I guess he couldn't remember stuff that happened recently, but he could remember what happened before. This guy I worked with, I think he had 6 kids, and one night they had a fire in the house, and Leonard Fitzgerald, the guy's name, he got out, and his wife got out, and I think 4 of the kids got out, and so there were still 2 kids missing. So he went back in to get the kids, and none of them ever came out. And let's see, that And there was a couple kids went up and got playing around that water reservoir for the town, and they fell in and drowned. This was in 6 months I was there. And I got to thinking, maybe it's time to get out of here. I'd quit working at Valsets because I couldn't live with the kind of life they had up there, eating with there, and that was one of the toughest things for me there was, you know, to even admit it to anybody, talk to anybody about it. I mean, I don't like to talk to people about it. Probably I told you more about it than I ever told anybody. I do, so.
Dad only worked that job for 6 months before he left Valsets to go home and learn to live with the diabetes. Valsets is gone now. In 1983, 30 years after my dad lived there, Boise Cascade owned Valsets and its workers. The wood products industry was in a tailspin, so the company decided to close the mill and set fire to the town. Mill workers were laid off from their jobs and then rehired by the company to bulldoze their own homes. Amidst the deafening dissent of the townspeople, the whole pile of rubble and all the memories it contained was burned to the ground. My father outlives the place where he was told he would die. He moved home, regrouped, found jobs as an upholsterer and as the foreman of a machine shop. He got married and raised a family of 4 boys. He leads a full life. Dad rarely speaks of it, but his diabetes is still out of control, and now at the age of 70, his eyes are deteriorating. Lately, I find myself sitting in the dark, listening to these tapes. I hear my dad's voice, and I see Oregon as a timber paradise. Valsets, population 300, the rainiest place in the nation. I see a train stacked high with boards, waiting to head down the mountain. There's a blind man and a house on fire, a funeral with tiny caskets. In the middle of it all is my father. He's young and strong, and he's smiling proudly, unaware of the quivering, bruised light in his eyes. I listen to him. And I wonder if he isn't telling me the story of who I am.
Okay, I'm getting my meter out. My Lancet device, which prick my finger. Get my test strip out. Put the test strip in the meter. Prick my finger. Squeeze the blood out. Put it on the test strip. Wait 15 seconds for the reading. I'll count down now. Down to 73, which is a little bit too low.
Where are you supposed to be?
Supposed to be between 80 and 120. And I guess about 23 is the lowest I've ever checked it. And that's, if I get it any lower now, I'm not able to check. And which I've had several, a lot of times. And I've had it up to check it where it's over. Over 500. So it varies quite a bit.
At what point do you just die?
I don't know. I've never experienced that yet.